You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Have you ever sat down one evening and thought to yourself, that was a day? If you wrote about that day, could its events, its trials, tribulations, highs, lows, mysteries, revelations, fill an entire book? Our next guest has made an impressive literary career of filling books, big ones, with storytelling about a world of his own creation, told from the perspective of a span of individual days. The same is true from his newest book, a standalone story that takes place in one day in his fictional world. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, a reader of fantasy fiction yourself? Have you ever worked to create your own fantasy world for a role-playing game, for your own writing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss is the author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. It kicked off with The Name of the Wind. His new book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires, set in the fictional world where his other novels take place. Fun fact, he was a guest on the pilot version of a radio show that eventually became this show. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, first off, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was I was an early adopter, but also that was the best, nicest lead-in I have heard in a mortal age. I am so tickled and I'm like really kind of blushy right now.
Oh, stop.
it's true. I never actually realized that. Yeah, I guess I do frame things in terms of days, which sounds silly now that I kind of admit that that wasn't intentional.
Wow. And I'll credit to our producer, Tim Peterson. I've read your books, but I didn't really, until I thought back, it's like, yeah, the novels were told. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of people in Wisconsin familiar with your work. For those who aren't, can you tell us a bit about the world that The Name of the Wind and the new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires, is set in?
That is a dangerous one, and I'll try to do it briefly.
How much time do we have? Yeah,
exactly. Everyone out there just heard me say briefly, and they're rolling their eyes. Fantasy... if you look at Tolkien, he wrote what is referred to as secondary world fantasy. It happens somewhere else. There's a lot of modern fantasy is written in this world, but different, or this world, but there's secrets. When I sat down to start this whole project, gosh, 20 years ago, I knew I wanted to tell a story in another world. But the thing that I wanted to avoid is something I've seen in so many of the books that I loved, but it broke my heart. At the end of The Lord of the Rings, Middle Earth is kind of done. The story exhausts the world. There can't ever be follow-ups because, like, the elves are leaving. And the story is so big that there's no room for more things to happen after it in the world without seeming anticlimactic. So when I started writing this story, I'm like, I want to tell a smaller story about a man's life. You know, what's, like, I've heard it referred to as the backstage pass to the myth of the hero. But after I always thought when I'm done telling this person's story, there's more world, more places, more people. So that's my world. A fun place to explore, but hopefully big enough. I always hoped for multiple stories. That's not very descriptive at all.
That's okay. But I actually want to take it to this new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You've actually done exactly what you just talked about in this and a previous book, taken one character, a secondary character from the main arc, and said, in effect, what is a day in their life look like? And it's a very different feel and a very different voice, but it allows you to explore another part of that world you created.
And, you know, it was something I stumbled into with Slow Regard, the book that should never have been written and I never thought would be published, the book where nothing happens, but that I love it anyway. And, this one, at least I could think, well, people do want to show up for effectively... You know, you get to see a secondary character live their own life. There's a term for that sort of episode in a TV show, but I don't know it because I don't do TV shows.
I wanted to talk about the challenge of writing fantasy, and I'm always impressed with this fantasy and some science fiction where, as you said, it's set not in our world. where, in addition to telling a story, you have to answer a lot of questions about how that world works. But also, I mean, and some old science fiction is, hey, here's an encyclopedia chapter for the first chapter, so you know where we are. The challenge of, like, working all that world building in while still, you know, advancing a plot.
It is the persistent issue, and it's one, you know, we all love Granddaddy Tolkien. We're in his shadow, and his shadow is long. And I love The Lord of the Rings, read it every year as a kid. It's got fingerprints all over my heart. But good Lord, that book starts slow, right? And he's like, hey, there's a place, and they have birthday parties, and they give gifts, and they're called Mathomes, and there's a museum. And so this guy is going to have a birthday, and here's what that birthday is like. And you're like, Tolkien, it's been 50 pages. What's going on here? And so what it's talked about in this day and age is you make this world, because you have to make a world to tell a story in it. And then you're kind of proud of it, and you want to show it off, and you have to show it off. But, you know, the rookie mistake is to, again, follow a little too closely in Tolkien's footsteps, and you show everything off, and you're excited because your baby is very smart and pretty, and you really want to talk about the cool religion you made or the magic you have. And it's called the info dump. In my experience, the problem isn't making a cool world. The problem is making it and then shutting up about it and doing a story instead. And I'm afflicted with it as much as anyone, because I do a wild amount of world building.
Talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, author of the series that starts with The Name of the Wind. A new book set in that world is just out, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions, your experiences reading fantasy literature, and a question I'm about to ask Patrick is, what kind of stuff do you like to read to your kids? Do you have fond memories of having things read to you by your parents growing up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Pat, you were mentioning your reading of The Lord of the Rings as a kid. I know you've talked online and elsewhere about, you know, what you like to read to your own kids. What is on your hit list? What kind of things do you look for to read to kids?
I do. You know, for a long time, for those of you out there that know what Goodreads is, I used to review a lot of books there. And then as I started to read more to my boys and look more at kids' books, I shifted almost entirely to sharing my many, many opinions about children's literature, because good Lord, if you're a careful parent who wants to limit a child's exposure to some really toxic cultural stuff, there's a lot to look out for in some of these classic books. But yeah, I never knew that Little House on the Prairie was real or a book until I already had kids. So I read all of them to the boys, editing on the fly to avoid, oof, there are some racist and sexist things in there. But still, they're fabulous. They're more fantastic than a lot of fantasy I've read. These days, though, my boys are 9 and 14. And there's very little, like, in terms of, like, age range that I wouldn't lay on them. You know, think of who their daddy is, right? So, I've read The Hobbit to them multiple times. They could practically sing along with the opening. Right now I'm rereading The Last Unicorn to them, one of my all-time favorite books. I read this book to them, only because on a lark, I was reading, Ursula K. Le Guin's, like, foundational, Wizard of Earthsea, which I love and they love, but it was not meant to be read out loud, and it was hard. And if you're doing it before bed, you don't want an extra job. And I'm like, maybe I could read them a little bit of Slow Regard, which I remembered being easy to read out loud because I did the audiobook. And I'm like, and I did it. And I immediately got self-conscious. And I said, you know what, boys, this was silly. I'm not going to read you my own. And they're like, please, please, please. And I read it. And they loved this story about nothing. They were so into it. And so I bounced this book off of them as well. And they helped me catch a few mistakes and they helped me work on the illustrations. So I read to them all the time. Not as much as I wish I would, but still an awful lot. Yeah.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss about some of his storytelling craft, including speculative fiction and world building, and his new book. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Have you already picked up the new book? Are you a writer yourself? Do you need maybe some inspiration for your own creativity? And do you have favorite things to read to kids? Or do you have a favorite memory of being read to as a kid? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss is with us talking about the craft of storytelling in his new book set in his fictional world. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to share a quick story of my aunt reading Shel Silverstein poems to us, my sister and I, and how much we just enjoyed that experience, how his words brought those poems to our imagination. And I forgot the titles. It's Another Light in the Attic, something like that. Perhaps the author knows.
A Light in the Attic. Yeah.
And John, I got to ask before I let you go, have you passed those on to a new generation or do you plan to?
Yes, we've kept them and I read them to my kids, but now my kids are 19, 21, 23. So we'll see. They'll be held on to for another generation.
My kids are that age. They don't let me read to them anymore either. But I had a great aunt who read Shel Silverstein to us as a kid. It's the poems that aunts read to kids, apparently, Pat.
Oh, Shel Silverstein just gave me like a tingle of joy. The boys would read some of that to each other. Mm. I also stumbled onto videos of Shel Silverstein reading his own stuff, which was wild. Like, it was not what I expected because he was an intense man.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Pat, in the new book, I get a little bit of a fairy tale feel to it for a couple of reasons, I think. Do you look to the worlds of fairy tales and folklore for some of your inspiration?
Absolutely. And for this one in particular, I kind of put my foot in it because I'm like, oh, you know, I actually studied fairy tales. I used to collect fairy tales. I'm like, back in my arrogant youth, I'm like, I just want to read all of the classic fairy tales, get them under my belt. You can't. There's so many and from all different cultures. However, when I'm like, I'll draw on some of those elements. And, you know, if I'm trying to fit some of those things into my world is not the world of, you know, medieval Europe, mm-hmm. or where the Grimm brothers were, or, you know, a lot of these, you know, this different mindset. So the cultural things don't fit together, but also trying to bring in and sort of be mindful of a different sort of morality, because these fairy tales were moral. Bruno Bettelheim wrote a great book. It's one of the few books written about fairy tales seriously, and it's called The Witch Must Die, because people think, oh, these were never meant for children. The thing is, yeah, they weren't meant just for children. Kids love them, and they don't mind terrible things in stories so long as the people who do terrible things are punished. And that sort of, it's reassuring because you're like, oh, there might be bad people, but they're going to get theirs. And like, and that is a more, I'm not saying it's the best morality, but there's a moral compass in there. And like the evil stepmother in Sleeping Beauty, at the end, she's safe. She's back. She's getting married. And at the wedding, they heat up a pair of iron shoes by the fire, make her wear them and dance until she dies. So like, that's old Testament morality there. But that doesn't really, you know, fit in the world I created. And it's not necessarily the morality that I want to spread in my own fiction. So, I mean, a little taste of that is fine, but I don't want that to be the end all be all. So trying to be socially responsible with what I'm sharing with the world, it's a little tricky because the old folk tales, they were dark, and fairies weren't really interested in important stuff like consent. And so I had some work to do there. Yeah.
Let's go back to our callers. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just want to tell Patrick how much I enjoy his writing. I picked up The Name of the Wind. I don't know why I picked it, you know, but I loved it so much. I shared it with my whole family. And I just finished reading The Slow Regard again because I liked that so much. I saw it at the library. And now the mystery to me just called and said, your new book is in. Could I come and get it? So that's what I'm doing.
Barbara, who gave you a call?
The Murder to Me bookstore, I think she was referring to.
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for that call. Patrick, you're at a point where you've got lots of fans out there. What does it feel like to, I don't know, just to have people out there looking forward to something, as Barbara did clearly, to picking up that book at the bookstore today?
You know, the proper answer is sort of the chirpy Hollywood interview answer, which is to say, oh, it's so great. And it is. I'm not saying that's not a true answer, but the really true answer is it's been like almost a decade since I published a book, and I've really felt bad about that, and I've beaten myself up about it. And there's books I've wanted to write, and there's books that people want to read from me. And then I do this book, and I know it's not the book some people want or wish for. And so it's not healthy, but I will admit, like, somebody asked me this exact question. Hey, you're getting a book out. How does it feel? Pretty good. And I'm like, actually, I have a sense of dread.
Oh, no.
Because I'm worried people will just be upset. It's not what they want. But hearing from people like that, I remember, like, you don't do things for the people that are going to be angry at you. Like, that shouldn't be my deciding thing. It's been so nice to hear it again and again as I put the book out. Some people are salty. It's not what they wanted, or it's been too long for them. But there's so many people who are kind and thoughtful, and they understand that life gets in the way, and it does me a world of good to hear that people still think of me fondly, honestly. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. I think I said Murder to Me, Mystery to Me bookstore. Talking to Patrick Rothfuss, author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. His latest book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires. It's been a while since we talked, Patrick, but I dimly recall that you really liked recommending books and sharing the stuff you're loving reading with other humans. You got any suggestions for us these days?
You know, when you're promoting a book, you know what your PR people hate is when you talk about another book that's coming out right now. But man, I'll do it every time. If you haven't read Murderbot, the Murderbot Diaries, I think I love it as much as I've loved anything that I've read that I've picked up new in these last 5 years. And you might think, what, Murderbot? I read a lot. And I don't know if I have loved anything as much as I've loved that. Read it multiple, multiple times. The audiobook is stunning by Kevin R. Free. It's by Martha Wells. And the newest one, Me and My Boys, honestly, I've been kind of excited and kind of dreading my own book release. The book release we've really been looking forward to in this household with untrammeled joy is Martha Wells' new Murderbot. Start at the beginning, though, and trust me, it's gorgeous. I've never empathized with a character as much as I've empathized with Murderbot.
All right. I will apologize to your PR people, Patrick.
No, I love it. Thank you for giving me the chance, because I'll talk about Murderbot all day. I would list 100 books, but I know that I shouldn't mention a book that's coming out literally right now. But absolutely, pick that one up. Then you can try mine.
And then go ahead. Yeah. Oh, well, actually, I just want to ask briefly in our last half a minute or so, Patrick, you've taught creative writing, including at your alma mater, UW Stevens Point, over the years. Quick bit of inspiration for somebody who wants to write for, you know, maybe they're going to publish a book, maybe it's just for fun. A quick bit of inspiration for them.
I'll say this. There's no right way to do it. And anyone who says this is the way, take their advice with a grain of salt. Instead, if you want to make a world, don't feel like you got to do what Tolkien did. He was a linguist, so he did languages. He was a historian, so he based it on the Eddas. If you love stamp collecting and butterflies, and that's what you're into, make a world that centers around that, and I will be there for your weird Lepidoptera fantasy novel, man.
Pat, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
So good to talk to you.
That's Wisconsin-born and raised Patrick Rothfuss, author of the Kingkiller Chronicle fantasy series, which kicked off with The Name of the Wind. We talked to him about his latest book called The Narrow Road Between Desires and many other things as well. If you have a favorite book that you like reading to kids, email ideas@WPR.org. We could share it on a future program. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As a hockey player at UW-Madison, Blake Jeffrion seemed to be destined for big things at the highest levels of the game. He had played for Team USA at many levels of youth hockey. He was drafted by an NHL team partway through college, elected to finish 4 years. After his senior year, he won the Hobie Baker Award as the top college hockey player in the country. Hockey was even in his blood. Pro hockey went back 4 generations, including the legendary Bernie Boom Boom Jeffrion, his grandfather. But just a couple years into his pro career, a horrific on-ice injury ultimately put an end to his playing days. A new book shares Blake's story. The author joins us now along with Blake Jeffrion himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you played competitive hockey yourself? What was your experience like in the sport? If you gave a big part of your life to any sport and your playing days ended, what was it like? How did you handle that transition? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sam Jeffries is a freelance writer and communications professional and a UW-Madison graduate. He's author of the book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And legendary UW-Madison hockey star Blake Jeffrion is with us as well. Blake, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Blake, first of all, this book covers some very painful moments in every way of the word in your story. A guy comes up to you and says, I want to write a book about these moments. Did you think twice about wanting to talk about it and relive it?
Yeah, I think my first reaction was, is this guy serious? Out of all the people and all the things in the world you could write a book about, why me? Was actually my knee-jerk and first reaction. But to answer your question more directly, I think everything in this world happens for a reason, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent. And I've taken the good, learned from the bad, and kind of moved on. I think that's how I've always been. That's how I was as a player. When Sam approached me, once I got past that, he was actually real and it wasn't a college buddy messing with me. I was kind of thumbs up and let's do this.
Sam, Blake set up my first question for you. Why Blake? What led you to want to tell his story?
I had gone to Madison and Blake and I overlapped and followed his incredible career, but then followed his pro career after as well, and saw that rise and then the tragedy that ended his playing time. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there was so much additional that I could share and tell, and that he really was the Forrest Gump of hockey, that he had been right place, right time for so many moments in the sport for decades. And so I don't think it was that hard of a sell to convince him that there was even more to his story than maybe he realized.
Now, Blake, your earliest memories of hockey. Now, I mentioned Hockey Dynasty, Boom Boom Jeffrey on the inventor of the slap shot. There are stories in the book about you riding your tricycle around in circles, pretending it's a Zamboni. What is your first memory of saying, this is what I want to do? I want to play hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's three defining moments that stick out, you know, big time for me. Number one would be, you know, just getting on the ice and understanding that feeling and pushing around a chair and learning how to skate. Two was, you know, the first time that I actually like scored a goal, and the sensation and feeling that ran through my body. And that's when I knew I was a true competitor since a very young age. And then I think three was when I was a fairly young kid, and I think this story's in the book, I was shooting pucks in the backyard, and my grandfather came out, Boom Boom Jeffrey on, and he goes, "That's not how you shoot the puck. You shoot the puck like this, Dare." And he took my little stick, flipped it over because I was lefty, he was a righty, missed the net and put a hole through my fence. And I remember like watching this puck like saucer perfectly and the whole thing. And then my dad instantly came out like, "Dad, what are you doing? I just built that fence." And, you know, after I saw my pappy shoot the puck, I was like, "Oh man, I want to be that guy." I think those are the three defining moments of my early childhood days of wanting to be a hockey player.
And Sam, we just heard that French Canadian accent of Blake's pappy there. But Blake's growing up in the Nashville, Tennessee area. You talk about this in the book. If at that time I was looking, I was a scout, I was going to find my next hockey star, Tennessee, I wasn't going to start there, right?
Probably not. Although hockey had been creeping to Tennessee for a while, and a cool Madison connection. Bob Suter, who was on the Miracle on Ice team and as a Wisconsin native, ended up playing for a minor league team in Nashville back after the Miracle on Ice and before his pro career really took off. So that creep had been going on for a while, but Blake's dad, Danny, and then the entire Jeff Brown family drove so much of that. And it really was an incredible thing for him to get drafted by his hometown team and be able to return to Nashville, you know, 10 plus years removed from his peewee days and wear the colors of the hometown NHL team.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth, and UW hockey star Blake Jeffrion himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, hockey memories of your own, join in at 800-642-1234. Blake, you have a great teen career going. Some people around the country very curious about where you are going to go to college. What took you to Madison?
Yeah, great question. Growing up as a kid, Michigan was always kind of my number one choice. You know, in the South, you know, the only college hockey games we got to see were the Michigan-Michigan State rival games or the national championship game or the Frozen Four. And usually Michigan was always in those games with those cool blue, you know, those blue helmets with the yellow stripes. Always wanted that helmet. And, Red Berenson, who was the coach for a long time there, was a good family friend of ours as well. So I think kind of those two were kind of the number one reasons why I wanted to go there. And really the punchline is, I'd lived in Ann Arbor for 2 years playing for Team USA and Ann Arbor's great, but I wanted something a little bit more and something, you know, a little bit different. And when I went to Madison and just saw the football game, the small city, although very similar to Ann Arbor around, you know, size, but a little bit bigger, a little bit more of a personality to the town, a little bit more swagger to the town, a great team. And then the ultimate, the Kohl Center. And then Mike Eaves, the head coach there at the time, his assistant, former assistant, John Hines, was my head coach at USA. And they had very similar styles of play and the way they looked at the game and whatnot. And I think when you combine all that, when I went to Madison, it was just like, oh, and don't forget the infamous college club owned by the Meyer family, because that was a selling point for me. And I think when you combine all of those, I mean, there was nothing that, you know, you wrap in the great education of Wisconsin, I mean, truthfully, I really don't think there's a better, you know, setup or college hockey program in the country. And I mean that, you know, wholeheartedly, not just because I went there. It's pretty hard to beat Madison.
Sam, UW-Madison had at various points been one of the biggest teams in the country, always at or near the top. What were things like by the time that Blake ends up going to UW-Madison for the hockey program in the late 2000s?
Yeah, so Blake comes in on the heels of the 2006 national championship, and both men's and women's team won that year. So it was really a crowning achievement for the program in so many ways, and has to inherit a team with high expectations and then have to deal with his own, no offense, but Blake, but big-headedness that doesn't matter what color the helmet was, probably couldn't fit it on. And it ended up being a struggle for the next couple of years, and really the pathway that I think he found himself and then the team under Mike Eaves found its way back to the national championship in 2010 and really put together an incredible run that culminated in so many ways in those Mike Eaves years.
Blake, actually, let's talk about that. Sam writes about this in the book. There were a couple points in your career and a couple big ones in college where you switched your approach to the game and became more of a student of the game, more team focused. Can you talk about what changed your attitude and led to a lot of your success?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think as an 18-year-old kid being drafted as a first round, a first pick, second round of your hometown team, coming off a world championship, entering college where the team that you're going to just won, coming off the national championship, and hang out with those guys and seeing what they're like and whatnot, and then going into freshman year, being like, this is going to be a cakewalk. Like, you know, as Sam alluded to, you know, I was big-headed, arrogant, and the whole thing, as I think any 18-year-old kid would be. You know, and look, I had to grow, I had to learn and grow up and mature. And that while I was a talented guy, I wasn't the most, it didn't come naturally to me. And the core competency of why I was a good player was my work ethic first and foremost. And if I wasn't working hard, a lot of other things weren't working, if at all. And, you know, I think it, just like anything in life, you go through, you know, iterations of as a player and as a person that, you need to kind of, once the season ended, I always would reflect on what I do well, what I do bad, what I need to improve on, what I need to get back to, what I need to learn from, and whatnot. And I think, you know, freshman year was a very humbling experience for me. And, you know, I got back to my core of, you know, not worrying about the extracurricular activities and, you know, focusing on the game and hockey and just working hard and then evolving from there and just keep getting better and better every year. You know, I think is the core of it.
We're talking to former pro hockey player and Badger star Blake Jeffrion, also with us Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Coming up, we'll talk about the injury that ended Blake's career just a few years into his pro stint. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a fan recently or for a long time of the UW hockey program? Did you yourself pour a lot of time and energy into playing a certain sport when those days ended? What did it mean to you? Join at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Blake Jeffrion, former Wisconsin Badger hockey star, professional hockey player, and Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, Blake, I want to take you now a couple years into your pro career. You've played with that hometown team in Nashville, traded to the Montreal Canadiens. It's the strike season. You're playing with the minor league team. What might look like a routine moment in hockey changed your life. if you're willing to, can you share your experience of that moment and what you remember of it and what came after?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember it was we were playing a game in the Bell Center. It was during the lockout, so we wanted to give something to the fans. I was playing for the Montreal Canadiens minor league team. My mom and dad flew up. They were actually in Boston watching my brothers play, and then drove up to Montreal to watch me. It was a couple shifts into the first period, and you know, puck turned over inside the blue line of our own end. I turned it up, and you know, was going on the boards, tried to jump out of the way of a hip check. And long and short is, you know, his skate went one way, my shoulder went the other, or head went the other. Kind of skate came up and hit me right in the side of the head. You know, I had suffered a lot of concussions in my career, both, you know, very, very minor to all of being knocked out and unconscious. So, I had known what a concussion felt like, and I'd known if I'd had one. And after that collision happened, which was a hard collision, I definitely thought I did. But when I, you know, as a, when that happens to me, usually my peripheral vision goes. So it looks like you're, you know, it seems as if you're looking down, like, look, you have two straws you're looking down. It's kind of the best way to describe it. And I didn't have that. So I was sitting on my knees and, you know, kind of waiting for a second. And then, you know, of course, a fight breaks out, or, you know, a scrum breaks out. And then, you know, I kind of stood up, I sat back, put my head up, and I just felt like a warm sensation go down my back, which was a bunch of blood. And then I was like, oh, man, I got to get off the ice. So I skated off the ice with my head kind of over, you know, and I get to the trainer's room. Or, I'm sorry, get to the bench, but my trainer's met with a towel. You know, he puts it up. I go into the trainer's room. They don't know where I'm kind of bleeding from. And, long story short is I had a pretty severe cut in the side of my head, and they, looked at it and kind of disappeared very quickly. Mind you, these guys all are speaking in French, so I don't know what they're saying, whatsoever. And, they come flying back 100 miles an hour with the doctor. The doctor says, you know, something very quickly in French. And everything started moving very quickly from there on out. You know, next thing I know, my mom and dad are down there. I'm in a stretcher and I'm off to the hospital. You know, the last memory I had before I went unconscious was, you know, I went into the hospital in a stretcher, looking up into those, you know, one of those rooms that's really cold. And, you know, I passed out. And the punchline there is, I had a depressed cold fracture and internal bleeding on my brain, which caused me to kind of, you know, go unconscious. Mm. So that was the last thing I remember until I woke up. You know, I don't remember how many hours, but a lot of hours later. So,
and Sam, I'm not an athlete. I'm a parent of athletes, not at Blake's level. My first thought was his parents are there, right? And when you see your kid down, you don't know what's happened. You talked to Blake's family members about their experience. Could you talk about how they talked about that moment?
Yeah, and it was really one of the amazing things for the Jeffreon family to be so open with me. His mom, Kelly, who's a tremendous storyteller, walked me through being in the stands and I think being a little casual when it first happened, because they have Blake is not their only son. They all play hockey. They've seen injuries before.
Yeah.
That's right. They've seen injuries. They've seen concussions. And I remember her telling me, oh, first thought was, oh, another concussion, and kind of, you know, girding themselves for that recovery. And it wasn't until being in the hospital and having to rush Blake to surgery that they really understood that this time was different and the seriousness of it, speaking French or not, that really came through very quickly. And so she was open and transparent, and then had to unfortunately be the one to make the call to Blake's fiance at the time, and his now wife, Kaylin. And Kaylin was taking a night off from law school, having well-deserved break with friends, and gets the call, not having in her mind Blake's playing schedule, not knowing where and when the game was that night. And, you know, immediately fell to her knees and broke down and really described being near catatonic, traveling from Chicago to Montreal to be with him bedside. So it was, you know, and everyone I talked to, there was a real delayed reaction. I think nobody understood the danger or the risks. And then I spoke to the surgeon and the trainer, and I think for the medical side, they all understood very quickly how bad this was, how close he was to do something far more severe than what happened, and how lucky it was that there was no NHL that night, because they actually had the best in the business sitting there ringside ready to help.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book, Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth, and Blake Jeffrion himself, former pro and UW-Madison hockey player. Blake, there's a moment in the book after this injury, the recovery, it takes time, it's difficult, and you're evaluating hockey, and the thought might be, oh, do you make a comeback, do you not? And it seems like you're asking yourself, even before the injury, was it worth it? Is this where I want to be? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, look, I think, I had suffered 13 documented concussions in my career. We all know the short-term and long-term effects of concussions, or what's out there. And, I had spoken to a lot of people, both former players, current players, neurologists. I mean, anyone and everyone, you pretty much name it, I had spoken to. And what the common theme that kept coming back was, Blake, it's actually, it's scientifically proven that it's not actually as a big of a deal if you suffer a lot of concussions. It's around two core competencies, and that is, number one, does the time period that you're out continue to get longer and longer? Is the first and foremost question you have to ask yourself. And then secondly, how often are they occurring, inside that? And I would say, historically, when I had suffered a concussion, I was usually back within, a couple of days to a week, feeling pretty much ready to go. And I would say my last two concussions that I had suffered previously were fairly within reach of each other. And both of those were, I was out longer term, and they were, each of those consecutively were longer durations of being out. And then when you suffer something like this, it's actually, substantially worse than a concussion, obviously. And, it's actually, a bruise to your brain. And everyone was just like, look, dude, you can go, if you can find a doctor to let you play and is willing to assume liability, by all means, best of luck to you on that one. But secondly, there's no way that you should come back and play. You should move on, live a long and happy life, and not have, long-term effects associated with this, and go do something else. And, so it's kind of writing on the wall, and that's how I'd always kind of made every decision, was kind of, if you talk to enough people, usually you get a gut feeling around it, the right decision to make, and it kind of slaps you in the face on what you should do in life. Turning to the ones you're closest with and people that know the most about that industry. And I think after I did that, it was kind of, the writing was on the wall. It was time for me to step away and go do something else.
You did continue to work in hockey. You did some time as a scout and into management. You still love the game?
I still do love the game. As you said, I went on to be a scout, and as I like to call it, a road warrior, and then into management. But ultimately, still love the game, still watch it. I just made a bet with my dad over the weekend that I still think Connor McDavid will lead the NHL in scoring this year. It's nice that he's got 11 points in his last three games. I still love the game, still follow pretty closely. I have a lot of friends that still play. Going through all this, I think the one thing that I've found is that family and friends are most important to me. And I was no longer willing to sacrifice those relationships in exchange for the game of hockey. So moved on to do something else.
I will leave it there. Blake, thanks for joining us today.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me. And Sam, as always, pal, good to see you. And thanks for writing the book, pal.
Yeah, and Sam, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the time and excited to hear what people think. It was a special journey to be able to write it and something else to have it out in the world and for Blake's kids and my own to be able to read it one day.
We've been talking to former pro hockey player and UW-Madison star Blake Jeffrion and author Sam Jeffries. Sam's new book is called Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth.